Side 7, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 291. "Some problem?" Lysian asked. "A wayward boy, cousin," Xavier told him. "From what I gather, he needs to be watched rather closely." "Beirut will find him," Calton laughed. "I have a great deal of confidence in that young man. Talon may come back with a few bumps and contusions, but I'm sure they'll be very educational for him." "Well, if it's all under control, then," Lysian said, "why don't I send word to the kitchen? I'm sure you're all hungry. And in the meantime, perhaps some wine?" He assumed a pious expression that was obviously feigned. "I know that the knights of the church are abstemious, but a touch or so of wine is good for the digestion, or so I've heard."
"I've heard that, too," Calton agreed.
"Could I prevail upon you for a cup of tea, my lord?" Sophronia asked. "And some milk for the little girl? I'm not sure that wine would be good for either of us."
"Of course, madam," Lysian replied jovially. "I should have thought of that myself."
It was mid-afternoon when Beirut returned with Talon in tow. "He was down near the harbor," the novice reported, still firmly holding the boy by the neck of his tunic. "I searched him thoroughly. He hadn't had time to steal anything yet."
"I just wanted to look at the sea," the boy protested. "I've never seen the sea before."
Curic was grimly removing his wide leather belt.
"Now wait a minute, Curic," Talon said, struggling to free himself from Beirut's grasp. "You wouldn't really do that, would you?"
"Watch me."
"I picked up some information," Talon said quickly. "If you thrash me, I'll keep it to myself."
He looked appealingly at Sparhawk.
"It's important," he said. "Tell him to put his belt back on, and I'll let you know what I found out."
"All right, Curic," Sparhawk said. "Let it pass, for the moment anyway." Then he looked sternly at the boy. "This had better be good, Talon," he threatened.
"It is, Sparhawk, believe me."
"Let's have it."
"Well, I was going down this street. As I said, I wanted to see the harbor and all the ships and things. Anyway, I was passing a wine shop and I saw a man coming out."
"Amazing," Calton said. "Do people in Mardell actually frequent wine shops?"
"You both know this man. It was Krager, the one you had me watching in Simera. I followed him. He went into a shabby-looking inn down by the waterfront. I can take you there if you want."
"Put your belt back on, Curic," Sparhawk said. "Do we have time for this?" Calton asked. "I think we should take time. Martell's already tried to interfere with us a couple times. If it was Anius who poisoned Alana, he'll definitely want to keep us from finding any kind of antidote. That means that Martell will try to get to Cypria before I do. We can wring that information out of Krager if we can catch him."
"We'll go with you," Tinian said eagerly. "This whole thing will be easier if we can cut Anius's hands off here in Mardell."
Sparhawk considered it, then shook his head. "I don't think so," he said. "Martell and his hirelings know Calton and me. He doesn't know the rest of you. If the two of us can't catch up with Krager, you'll all be looking around Mardell for him. That's going to be easier if he doesn't know what you look like."
"Makes sense," Euloth agreed.
Tinian looked profoundly disappointed.
"Sometimes you think too much, Sparhawk," he said.
"It's a trait of his," Calton told him.
"Will these cloaks of ours attract any attention in the streets of Mardell, my lord?" Sparhawk asked the Marquis.
Lysian shook his head. "It's a port city," he said. "There are people here from all over the world, so two more strangers won't attract that much notice."
"Good," Sparhawk said.
He started toward the door with Calton and Talon at his heels.
"We should be back before long," he said.
They left their horses behind and went into the city on foot. Mardell was situated on an estuary, and the smell of the sea was very strong, carried inland by a stiff onshore breeze. The streets were narrow and crooked, and grew increasingly run down as the two knights and the boy approached the harbor.
"How far is this inn?" Calton asked.
"Not too much farther," Talon assured him.
Sparhawk stopped. "Did you get the chance to look around a bit after Krager went inside?" he asked the boy.
"No. I was going to, but Beirut caught me before I had time."
"Why don't you do it now? If Calton and I go marching up to the front door and Krager happens to be watching, he'll be out the back door before we get inside. See if you can find that back door for us."
"Right,"
Talon said, his eyes sparkling with excitement. He scurried off down the street.
"Good lad there," Colton said, in spite of his bad habits. He frowned. How do you know this inn has a back door? He asked. Every inn has a back door, Colton. In case of fire, if nothing else. I guess I hadn't thought of that. When Talon returned, he was running as hard as he could. There were about 10 men chasing him. In the lead, roaring unintelligibly, was Otis.
Look out!
Talon shouted as he ran past. Sparhawk and Colton whipped their swords out from under their cloaks and stepped slightly apart to meet the charge. The men following Otis were shabbily dressed and carried a variety of weapons, rusty swords, axes, and spiked maces.
Kill them!
Otis bellowed, slowing slightly and waving his men on. The fight was short. The men rushing up the narrow street appeared to be common waterfront roughnecks, and they were no match for the 2 trained knights. 4 of them were down before the others realized that they had made a tactical blunder. 2 more collapsed onto the bloody stones before the rest could turn to flee. Then Sparhawk leaped over the sprawled bodies and rushed at Otis. The brute parried the knight's first stroke, then seized his sword hilt in both hands and flailed at Sparhawk with it. Sparhawk easily deflected those blows and countered deftly, inflicting painful cuts and bruises on his opponent's mailed ribs and shoulders. After a moment, Otis fled, running hard and clutching at his side with a bloody hand.
"Why didn't you chase him?"
Colton demanded, coming up puffing and with his blood-smeared sword still in his hand. "Because Otis can run faster than I can," Sparhawk shrugged. "I've known that for years." Talon came back down the street, breathing hard. He looked admiringly at the hacked and bleeding bodies sprawled on the cobblestones.
"Well done, my lords," he congratulated them.
"What happened?" Sparhawk asked.
"I went on past the inn."
Talon shrugged.
"Then I went around back. That big one who just got away was hiding in the alley with these others. He made a grab for me, but I dodged. Then I ran."
"Good thinking," Colton said. Sparhawk sheathed his sword. "Let's get away from here," he said. "Why not follow at us?" Colton asked. "Because they're setting traps for us. Martell's using Kroger as bait to lead us around by the nose. That's probably why we keep finding him so easily."
"Would that mean that they can recognize me as well?"
Talon sounded shocked. "Probably," Sparhawk said. "They found out that you were working for me in Simra, remember? Kroger probably knew that you were following him around and gave your description to Otis. Otis may not have a brain, but his eyes are sharp." He muttered an oath. "Martell's even more clever than I thought, and he's starting to irritate me." "It's about time," Colton murmured as they started back up the crooked street. Part 3. Dabur. Chapter 17. A purple twilight was settling in the narrow streets of Madel, and the stars were coming out. Sparhawk, Colton, and Talon moved through the narrow, crooked streets, frequently turning corners and occasionally even doubling back to throw off anyone who might possibly be following them.
"Aren't we being just a little overcautious?" Colton said after about a half hour.
"Let's not take any chances with Martell," Sparhawk replied. "He's entirely capable of throwing a few people away just for the chance to hunt us down. I'd rather not wake up in the middle of the night to find Lysian's house surrounded by mercenaries."
"You've got a point there, I suppose." They slipped out through the west gate of Madel as the light faded even more.
"In here," Sparhawk said as they passed a thicket some distance up the road. "Let's wait for a while and make sure that no one's trying to follow us." They crouched down among the rustling saplings and peered back along the road leading down to the city. A sleepy bird somewhere in the thicket muttered complainingly, and then an ox cart with creaking wheels passed, rumbling slowly down the road toward Madel.
"It's not too likely that anybody's going to leave town this close to nightfall, is it?" Colton asked quietly.
"That's what I'm counting on," Sparhawk told him. "Anybody who comes out now probably has serious business."
"And the business could be us, right?"
"It's altogether possible." A creaking sound came from the city, followed by a dull boom and the rattling of a heavy chain.
"They just closed the gate," Talon whispered.
"That was what I was waiting for," Sparhawk said, rising to his feet. "Let's go." They emerged from the thicket and continued along the road. Stands of trees loomed up out of the darkness on either side, and clumps of shadowy bushes lined the edges of the field, stretching off into the night. Talon nervously stayed close to the two knights, his eyes darting this way and that.
"What's the matter, boy?"
Colton asked him.
"I've never been out in the countryside after dark before," Talon explained. "Is it always this black?"
The blond man shrugged. "That's why they call it night."
"Why doesn't somebody put up some torches?"
Talon complained.
"What for?
So the rabbits can see where they're going?" Lysian's house stood in the deep shadows of the surrounding evergreens with only a single torch at the gate.
Talon was visibly relieved when they walked into the graveled yard in front of the entrance.
"Any luck?" Tinian asked, emerging from the main entrance.
"We ran into some trouble," Sparhawk replied.
"Let's go inside."
"I told you that you should have let the rest of us come along," the bulky-shouldered Alcyone said accusingly as they entered the building.
"It wasn't that much trouble," Colton assured him. The others were waiting in the large room to which Lysian had first led them. Sophrenia rose to her feet, looking closely at the blood spatters on the two Pandion's cloaks.
"Are you all right?"
she asked, her voice mirroring her concern.
"We ran into a group of sportive fellows," Colton replied lightly. He looked down at his cloak. "The blood is all theirs."
"What happened?"
she asked Sparhawk.
"Ardis tried to ambush us when we got to the inn," he told her. "He had a group of waterfront toughs with him."
He paused reflectively.
"You know, we've been running across Kroger just about every time we turn around. Once or even twice might have been sheer coincidence, but it's starting to happen just a little too frequently. And every time we try to follow him, there's some kind of ambush."
"You think it's deliberate?" Tinian asked.
"It's beginning to look that way, isn't it?"
"Would this Martell put a friend in such danger?"
Bavier sounded surprised.
"Martell doesn't have any friends," Sparhawk told him. "Ardis and Kroger are hirelings, nothing more. They're useful, but he feels no particular attachment for them. I don't think he'd shed many tears if something happened to Kroger."
He began to pace up and down, staring thoughtfully at the floor.
"Maybe we can turn the tables on him."
He looked at Colton.
"Why don't you let yourself be seen in the streets of Mardell?" he suggested. "Don't take too many chances, but let people know you're in town."
"Why not?" Colton shrugged.
Tinian grinned.
"Martell and his hirelings don't know the rest of us, so we can sort of loiter along behind Colton without attracting attention. Is that the idea?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"If they think Colton's alone, it might bring them out into the open.
I'm getting a little tired of Martell's games, so maybe it's time for us to play a few of our own."
He looked at Bavier's cousin.
"How excited do the local authorities get about street brawls, my lord?" he asked.
Lysian laughed.
"Mardell is a seaport, Sir Sparhawk. Brawling is second nature to sailors. The authorities don't pay much attention to their little scuffles, except to remove the bodies, of course. Public sanitation, you understand."
"Good."
Sparhawk looked at his friends. "You may not get a chance at Kroger or Ardis, but you might be able to divide Martell's attention. That could be what it takes to get Curic and Sophrenia and me aboard a ship unnoticed. I'd rather not have to keep looking over my shoulder when we get to Cypria."
"About the only tricky part is going to be getting you to the harbor without being seen," Colton said.
"It won't be necessary to go to the harbor," Lysian said. "I have some warehouses on the river about 5 miles from here. A fair number of independent sea captains deliver cargoes to me there, and I'm sure arrangements for your passage can be made without any need for going into the city."
"Thank you, my lord," Sparhawk said. "That solves a problem."
"When do you plan to leave?" Tinian asked.
"I don't see much point in delaying."
"Tomorrow, then?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"I need to talk with you, Sparhawk," Sophrenia said. "Would you mind coming to my room?"
He followed her out of the door, slightly puzzled.
"Is it something we can't discuss in front of the others?" he asked her.
"It might be better if they don't hear us arguing."
"Are we going to argue?"
"Probably."
She opened the door to her room and led him inside. Flute sat cross-legged on the bed, her dark eyebrows knit in concentration as she wove the intricate mesh of a cat's cradle out of a strand of wool yarn. It was far more complex than the one Talon had made when he had demonstrated it to her. She looked up, smiled at them, and proudly extended her little hands to show them her handiwork.
She'll be going with us, Sophronia said.
Absolutely not, Sparhawk said sharply.
I told you we'd argue about this.
It's an absurd idea, Sophronia.
We all do many absurd things, dear one. She smiled affectionately at him.
Don't do that, he said. You're not going to win me over that way.
Don't be tiresome, Sparhawk. You've been around her long enough to know that she always does what she decides to do, and she's decided that she's going with us to Rendor.
She won't if I have anything to say about it.
That's the whole point, Sparhawk. You don't. You're dealing with something you can't understand. She's going to come with us in the end anyway, so why not just give in gracefully?
Gracefulness is not one of my strong points.
I've noticed.
All right, Sophronia, he said flatly. Just who is she, anyway? You recognized her the first moment we saw her, didn't you?
Of course.
Why, of course? She's only about 6 years old, and you haven't left the Pandions for generations. How could you possibly know her?
She sighed. Eileen logic always clouds an issue with facts. The child and I are kindred in a rather peculiar sense of the word. We know each other in a way you couldn't begin to comprehend.
Thanks, he said dryly.
I'm not belittling your intelligence, dear one, she told him. But there's a part of Styric life you're not prepared to accept, either intellectually or philosophically.
He frowned slightly. His eyes narrowed in thought. All right, Sophronia, he said. Let me have a try at the Eileen logic you're so fond of dismissing. Flute is a child, hardly more than a baby.
The little girl made a face at him.
He ignored that and went on. She suddenly appeared in an uninhabited region near the Arshan border, far from any kind of human habitation. We tried to leave her at that nunnery south of Dara, and she not only managed to escape, but also got a goodly distance ahead of us, even though we were traveling at a gallop. Then she somehow managed to persuade Farron to let her on his back, and Farron won't let anybody near him except me unless I tell him to. When she met Dolmant, you could tell by his face that he sensed something very unusual about her. Not only that, you bully full-grown knights like a drill sergeant, but any time Flute decides to do something or go someplace, you give in without a fight. Wouldn't you say that all of that suggests that she's not an ordinary child?
You're the one who's exercising his logic. I wouldn't dream of interfering.
All right, then. Let's see where logic takes us. I've seen a fair number of Styrics. With the exception of you and the other magicians, they're all fairly primitive and not very bright. No offense intended, of course.
Of course.
Her expression was amused. Since we've already established the fact that Flute is not an ordinary child, what does that leave us?
What would be your guess, Sparhawk?
Since she's not ordinary, she must be special. In Styricum, that can only mean one thing. She's a magician. Nothing else could explain her.
She applauded ironically.
Excellent, Sparhawk, she congratulated him. But that's impossible, Sophronia. She's only a child. She hasn't had time to learn the secrets.
Some few are born with that knowledge. Besides, she's older than she looks.
How old?
You know that I won't tell you that. The knowledge of the exact moment of one's birth can be a powerful weapon in the hands of an enemy. A disturbing thought came to him.
You're preparing for your own death, aren't you, Sophronia? If we fail, the 12 Pandions who were in the throne room with you will die, one by one, and then you'll die, too.
You're preparing Flute to be your successor.
She laughed.
Now that, dear Sparhawk, is a very interesting idea. I'm surprised you came up with it, considering the fact that you're an Eileen.
That's a very irritating habit you've picked up lately, you know. Don't try to be mysterious with me, Sophronia, and don't treat me like a child just because I'm an Eileen.
I'll try to remember that.
You'll agree to let her come with us, then?
Do I have any choice?
No, as a matter of fact, you don't. They rose early the next morning and gathered in the dew-drenched yard in front of Marquis Lysian's house. The newly risen sun was very bright, and it slanted down through the trees, casting the peculiarly bluish-colored shadows of early morning.
I'll get word to you from time to time, Sparhawk told those who were remaining behind.
Be careful down there, Sparhawk,
Fulton said. I'm always careful. Sparhawk swung himself up onto Farron's back.
Godspeed, Sir Sparhawk, Bavier said.
Thank you, Bavier. Sparhawk looked around at the other knights. Don't be so glum, gentlemen, he told them. If we're lucky, this won't take very long. He looked at Calton again. If you run into Martell, give him my regards. Calton nodded.
With an axe in the face, I think.
Marquis Lysian mounted a fat bay horse and led the way out onto the road which passed his house. The morning was crisp, though not actually cold. Spring, Sparhawk decided, was not very far off. He shifted his shoulders slightly. The sober businessman's doublet Lysian had lent him did not really fit very well. It bound in some places and was uncomfortably loose in others. We'll turn off just up ahead, Lysian told them. There's a track through the woods that leads down to my wharves and the little settlement that's grown up around them. Will you want me to bring your horses back after you go on board ship? No, my lord, Sparhawk replied. I think we'll take them with us. We don't know exactly what's going to happen in Rendor. We might need dependable mounts, and I have seen what passes for a horse in Cypria. What Lysian had modestly called a little settlement turned out to be a fair-sized village, complete with shipyards, houses, inns, and taverns. A dozen vessels were moored at the wharves, with longshoremen swarming over them. Quite an operation, my lord, Sparhawk said as they rowed down the muddy street toward the river. One has had a certain success, Lysian said self-deprecatingly. He smiled. Besides, I save enough in moorage fees to offset more than the cost of keeping the place up. He looked around. Why don't you and I step into that tavern over there, Sir Sparhawk, he suggested. The independent sea captains favor that one. All right, Sparhawk agreed. I'll introduce you as Master Clough, Lysian said as he swung down from his bay. It's not much of a name, I'll admit, but it's fairly nondescript, and I've discovered that seafaring men love to talk, but they're not always very selective in their choice of listeners. I've gathered that you might prefer to keep this business of yours more or less confidential. You're perceptive, my lord, Sparhawk replied, also dismounting. This shouldn't take too long, he said to Curic and Sophrenia. Isn't that what you said the last time you went to Rendor? Curic asked him. We can all hope that this time might be different. Lysian led the way into a rather sedate wharfside tavern. The ceiling was low, with dark, heavy beams decorated here and there with ship's lanterns. There was a broad window near the front, and golden morning sunlight streamed in through it, setting the fresh straw on the floor to gleaming. Several substantial-looking men of middle years sat at a table by the window, talking over brimming tankards. They looked up as the Marquis led Sparhawk to their table. "My lord," one of them respectfully greeted Lysian. "Gentlemen," Lysian said. This is Master Clough, an acquaintance of mine. He's asked me to introduce him. They all looked at Sparhawk inquiringly. I have a bit of a problem, gentlemen, Sparhawk told them. May I join you? Have a seat, one of the sea captains, a solid-looking man with silver-shot curly hair, invited. I'll leave you, gentlemen, then, Lysian said. There's something that needs my attention. He inclined his head slightly, turned, and went back out of the tavern. He probably wants to see if there's some way he can raise the mooring fees, one of the captains said wryly. My name's Sorgi, the captain with the curly hair introduced himself to Sparhawk. What's this problem you mentioned, Master Clough? Sparhawk coughed slightly, as if a little embarrassed. Well, he said, it all started a few months ago. I happened to hear about a lady who lives not far from here, he began, embellishing as he went along. Her father is old and very wealthy, so the lady stands to inherit a sizable estate. One of my problems has always been the fact that I have some expensive tastes and very little in my purse to support them. It occurred to me that a rich wife might solve that problem. That makes sense, Captain Sorgi said. That's about the only reason I can think of for getting married at all. I couldn't agree more, Sparhawk replied. Anyway, I wrote her a letter pretending that we had some mutual friends, and I was a little surprised when she answered my letter with a great deal of warmth. Our letters grew more and more friendly, and she finally invited me to call on her. I went even deeper in debt to my tailor and set out for her father's house in high spirits and splendid new clothes.
"Sounds to me as if everything was going according to your plan, Master Clough," Sorge said. "What's this problem of yours?"
"I'm just getting to that, Captain. The lady is of middle years and very wealthy. If she were even remotely presentable, someone would have snapped her up years ago, so I didn't have my hopes too high on that score. I assumed that she was plain, perhaps even homely. I had not, however, expected a horror." He feigned a shudder. "Gentlemen, I cannot even describe her to you. No matter how rich she was, it wouldn't have been worth waking up to that every morning. We spoke together briefly, about the weather, I think, and then I made my apologies and left. She has no brothers, so I wasn't worried about the possibility of someone looking me up to object to my bad manners. What I didn't count on, though, was all her cousins. She's got a whole platoon of them. They've been following me for weeks now."
"They don't want to kill you, do they?" Sorge asked.
"No," Sparhawk replied in an anguished tone. "They want to drag me back and force me to marry her." The captains all roared with laughter, pounding on the table in glee.
"I think you've outsmarted yourself, Master Clough," one of them said, wiping the tears of mirth from his eyes.
Sparhawk nodded glumly. "You're probably right," he admitted.
"You should have found some way to get a look at her before you sent the first letter," Sorge grinned.
"I know that now," Sparhawk agreed.
"Anyhow, I think it's time I left the country for a while, until the cousins stop looking for me. I've got a nephew living in Cypria in Rendor who's been doing fairly well of late. I'm sure I can impose on him until I can get my feet on the ground again."
"Is it possible that one of you gentlemen might be sailing there soon? I'd like to book passage for myself and a couple of family retainers. I'd go to the main docks in Madel, but I've got a strong feeling that the cousins are watching them."
"What say you, gentlemen?" Captain Sorge said expansively. "Shall we help this good fellow out of his predicament?"
"I'm going to Rendor right enough," one of the others replied, "but I'm committed to Jirok." Sorge thought about it.
"I was going to Jirok myself," he mused, "and then on to Cypria. But I might be able to rearrange my schedule just a bit."
"I won't be able to help," a rough-voiced sea captain growled. "My ship's having her bottom scraped. I can give you some advice, though. If these cousins are watching the main wharves in Madel, they're probably watching these as well. Everybody in town knows about Lysian's docks here." He tugged at one earlobe. "I've smuggled a few people out of a few places in my time, when the price was right."
He looked at the captain who was bound for Jirok.
"When do you sail, Captain Mobbin?"
"With the noon tide."
"And you?"
the helpful captain asked Sorge.
"The same."
"Good. If the cousins are watching the docks here, they may try to hire a ship and follow our bachelor friend. Have him openly board Mobbin's ship. Then, when you're downriver a ways and out of sight, transfer him to Sorge's ship. If the cousins decide to follow, Mobbin can lead them off toward Jirok, and Master Clough will be safe on his way to Cypria. That's the way I'd do it."
"You've got a very ingenious mind, my friend," Sorge laughed. "Are you sure that people are the only things you've smuggled in the past?"
"We've all avoided customs officers from time to time, haven't we, Sorge?" the rough-voiced captain said. "We live at sea. Why should we pay taxes to support the kingdoms of the landsmen? I'd gladly pay taxes to the king of the ocean, but I can't seem to find his palace."
"Well said, my friend," Sorge applauded.
"Gentlemen," Sparhawk said, "I'm eternally in your debt."
"Not exactly eternally, Master Clough," Sorge said. "A man who admits to having financial difficulties pays for his passage before he boards. He does on my ship, at least."
"Would you accept half here and half when we reach Cypria?" Sparhawk countered.
"I'm afraid not, my friend. I like you well enough, but I'm sure you can see my position in the matter."
Sparhawk sighed. "We have horses," he added. "I suppose you'll charge extra to carry them as well?"
"Naturally."
"I was afraid of that." The loading of Farron, Sophronia's palfrey, and Curic's stout gelding took place behind a screen of sailcloth Sorgi's sailors were ostensibly mending. Shortly before noon, Sparhawk and Curic boarded the ship bound for Jirok. They moved openly up the gangway, followed by Sophronia, who carried flute in her arms. Captain Mauban greeted them on the quarterdeck.
"Ah," he grinned, "here's our reluctant bridegroom. Why don't you and your friends walk around the deck until we sail? Give all the cousins plenty of chances to see you."
"I've had a few second thoughts about this, Captain Mauban," Sparhawk said. "If the cousins hire a ship and follow you, and if they catch up with you, it's going to be fairly obvious that I'm not on board."
"Nobody's going to catch up with me, Master Clough," the captain laughed. "I've got the fastest ship on the inner sea. Besides, it's obvious that you don't know very much about seafaring etiquette. Nobody boards another man's ship at sea unless he's prepared for a fight. It's just not done."
"Oh," Sparhawk said. "I didn't know that." "We'll stroll around the deck, then."
"Bridegroom?" Sophronia murmured as they moved away from the captain.
"It's a long story," Sparhawk told her.
"There seem to be a fair number of these long stories cropping up lately. Some day we'll have to sit down so that you can tell them to me."
"Some day, perhaps."
"Flute," Sophronia said quite firmly, "come down from there."
Sparhawk looked up. The little girl was halfway up a rope ladder stretching from the rail to the yardarm. She pouted just a bit, then did as she was told.
"You always know exactly where she is, don't you?"
he asked Sophronia.
"Always," she replied.
The transfer from one ship to the other took place in mid-river, some distance downstream from Lycian's wharves, and was concealed by a great deal of activity on both ships. Captain Sorgi quickly bustled his passengers below decks to get them out of sight, and then the two ships proceeded sedately downriver, bobbing side by side like two matrons returning home from church. "We're passing the wharves of Madel," Sorgi called down the companionway to them some short time later. "Keep your face out of sight, Master Clough, or I may have a deck full of your betrothed's cousins on my hands."
"This is really making me curious, Sparhawk," Sophronia said. "Couldn't you give me just the tiniest clue?"
"I made up a story," he shrugged. "It was lurid enough to seize the attention of a group of sailors."
"Sparhawk's always been very good at making up stories," Curic observed. "He used to lie himself in and out of trouble regularly when he was a novice."
The grizzled squire was seated on a bunk with the drowsing flute nestled in his lap.
"You know," he said quietly, "I never had a daughter. They smell better than little boys, don't they?"
Sophronia burst out laughing.
"Don't tell us, Laddie," she cautioned. "She may decide to try for one."
Curic rolled his eyes upward in dismay.
"Not again," he said. "I don't mind babies around the house, but I couldn't bear the morning sickness again."
About an hour later, Sorgi came down the companionway.
"We're clearing the mouth of the estuary now," he reported, "and there's not a single vessel to the rear. I'd say that you've made good your escape, Master Clough."
"Thank God," Sparhawk replied fervently.
"Tell me, my friend," Sorgi said thoughtfully, "is the lady really as ugly as you say?"
"Captain Sorgi, you wouldn't believe how ugly."
"Maybe you're a bit too delicate, Master Clough. The sea's getting colder, my ship's getting old and tired, and the winter storms are making my bones ache. I could stand a fair amount of ugliness if the lady's estate happened to be as large as you say. I might even consider returning some of your passage money in exchange for a letter of introduction. Maybe you overlooked some of her good qualities."
"We could talk about that, I suppose," Sparhawk conceded.
"I need to go topside," Sorgi said. "We're far enough past the city that it's safe for you and your friends to come on deck now." He turned and went back up the companionway.
"I think I can save you all the trouble of telling me that long story you mentioned earlier," Sophronia told Sparhawk.
"You didn't actively use that tired old fable about the ugly heiress, did you?"
He shrugged.
"As Vanion says, the old ones are the best." "Oh, Sparhawk, I'm disappointed in you. How are you going to avoid giving that poor captain the imaginary lady's name?"
"I'll think of something,"
Why don't we go up on deck before the sun sets?
Keurig spoke in a whisper.
I think the child's asleep, he said. I don't want to wake her. You two go on ahead.
Sparhawk nodded and led Sophronia out of the cramped cabin.
I always forget how gentle he is, Sophronia said softly.
Sparhawk nodded. He's the best and kindest man I know, he said simply. If it weren't for class distinctions, he'd have made an almost perfect knight.
Is class really all that important?
Not to me it isn't, but I didn't make the rules.
They emerged on deck in the slanting late afternoon sunlight. The breeze blowing offshore was brisk, catching the tops of the waves and turning them into sun-splashed froth.
Captain Mobbin's vessel, bound for Jirok, was heeling over in that breeze on a course almost due west through the broad channel of the Arshan Strait. Her sails bellied out, snowy white in the afternoon sun, and she ran before the wind like a skimming seabird.
"How far do you make it to Cypria, Captain Sorgi?" Sparhawk asked as he and Sophronia stepped up onto the quarterdeck.
150 leagues, Master Clough," Sorgi replied. 3 days if this wind holds."
"That's good time, isn't it?"
Sorgi grunted.
"We could make better if this poor old tub didn't leak so much."
"Sparhawk!" Sophronia gasped, taking him urgently by the arm.
"What is it?"
He looked at her in concern. Her face had gone deathly pale.
"Look!"
She pointed. Some distance from where Captain Mobbin's graceful ship was running through the Arshan Strait, a single densely black cloud had appeared in an otherwise unblemished sky. It seemed somehow to be moving against the wind, growing larger and more ominously black by the moment. Then it began to swirl, ponderously at first, but then faster and faster. As it spun, a long dark finger twitched and jerked down from its center, reaching down and down until its inky tip touched the roiling surface of the strait. Tons of water were suddenly drawn up into the swirling maw as the vast funnel moved erratically across the heaving sea.
"Waterspout!" the lookout shouted down from the mast. The sailors rushed to the rail to gape in horror at the swirling spout. Inexorably, the vast thing bore down on Mobbin's helpless ship, and then the vessel, which suddenly appeared very tiny, vanished in the seething funnel. Chunks and pieces of her timbers spun out of the great waterspout hundreds of feet in the air to settle with agonizing slowness to the surface again. A single piece of sail fluttered down like a stricken white bird.
Then, as suddenly as they had come, the black cloud and its deadly waterspout were gone. So was Mobbin's ship. The surface of the sea was littered with debris, and a vast cloud of white gulls appeared, swooping and diving over the wreckage, as if to mark the vessel's passing.
Chapter 18.
Captain Sorgi combed the wreckage-strewn water where Mobbin's ship had gone down until after dark, but he found no survivors. Then, sadly, he turned his ship southeasterly again, setting his course toward Cypria.
Sophronia sighed and turned from the rail.
"Let's go below, Sparhawk."
He nodded and followed her down the companionway. Keurig had lighted a single oil lamp, and it swung from a low overhead beam, filling the small, dark-paneled compartment with swaying shadows. Flute had awakened, and she sat at the bolted-down table in the center of the cabin, looking suspiciously at the bowl sitting in front of her.
"It's just stew, little girl," Keurig was saying to her. "It won't hurt you."
She delicately dipped her fingers into the thick gravy and lifted out a dripping chunk of meat. She sniffed at it, then looked questioningly at the squire.
"Salt pork," he told her.
She shuddered and dropped the chunk back into the gravy. Then she firmly pushed the bowl away.
"Styrics don't eat pork, Keurig," Sophronia told him.
"The ship's cook said that this is what the sailors eat," he said defensively. He looked at Sparhawk. "Was the captain able to find any survivors from the other ship?"
Sparhawk shook his head.
"That waterspout tore it all to pieces. The same thing probably happened to the crew."
"It's lucky we weren't on board that one."
"Very lucky," Sophronia agreed. "Waterspouts are like tornadoes. They don't appear out of completely clear skies, and they don't move against the wind or change direction the way that one did. It was being consciously directed."
"Magic?" Keurig said. "Is that really possible? To call up weather like that, I mean?"
I don't think I could do it.
Who did, then?
I don't know for certain. Her eyes, however, showed a certain suspicion.
Let's get it out into the open, Sophronia, Sparhawk said. You've guessed something, haven't you?
Her expression grew a bit more certain. In the past few months, we've had several encounters with a hooded figure in a styric robe. You saw it several times in Cimera, and it tried to have us ambushed on our way to Barata. Styrics seldom cover their faces. Have you ever noticed that?
Yes, but I don't quite make the connection.
This thing had to cover its face, Sparhawk. It's not human.
He stared at her.
Are you sure?
I can't be absolutely positive until I see its face. But the evidence is beginning to pile up, wouldn't you say?
Could Aeneas actually do something like that?
It's not Aeneas.
He might know a little rudimentary magic, but he couldn't begin to raise a thing like that.
Only Azash could have done it. He's the only one who dares to summon such beings. The younger gods will not, and even the other elder gods have forsworn the practice.
Why would Azash want to kill Captain Mabin and his crew?
The ship was destroyed because the creature thought that we were on board.
That goes a little far, Sophronia, Curic objected skeptically. If it's so powerful, why did it sink the wrong boat?
The creatures of the underworld are not very sophisticated, Curic, she replied. Our simple ruse may have deceived it. Power and wisdom don't always go hand in hand. Many of the greatest magicians of Styricum were as stupid as stumps.
I don't quite follow this, Sparhawk admitted with a puzzled frown. What we're doing has nothing to do with Zamok. Why would Azash go out of his way to help Aeneas?
It may be that there isn't any connection. Azash always has his own motives. It's quite possible that what he's doing has nothing to do with Aeneas at all.
It doesn't wash, Sophronia. If you're right about this thing, it's been working for Martell, and Martell works for Aeneas.
Are you so sure that the creature is working for Martell and not the other way around? Azash can see the shadows of the future. One of us might be a danger to him. The seeming alliance between Martell and the creature may be no more than a matter of convenience.
He began to gnaw worriedly at a fingernail. That's all I need, he said. Something else to worry about. Then a thought struck him. Wait a minute. Do you remember what the ghost of Lacus said? That darkness was at the gate, and that Elana was our only hope of light? Could Azash be that darkness? She nodded.
It's possible.
If that's the case, then wouldn't it be Elana he's trying to destroy? She's totally protected by that crystal that encases her. But if something happens to us before we can find a way to heal her, she'll die too. Maybe that's why Azash has joined forces with the primate. Aren't you both stretching things a bit? Curic asked. You're basing a great deal of speculation on a single incident. It doesn't hurt to be ready for eventualities, Curic, Sparhawk replied. I hate surprises. The squire grunted and rose to his feet. You two must be hungry, he said. I'll go down to the galley and get you some supper. We can talk some more while you're eating.
No pork, Sophronia told him firmly.
Bread and cheese, then, he suggested, and maybe some fruit?
That would be fine, Curic.
You'd probably better bring enough for Flute as well. I know she's not going to eat that stew. That's all right, he said. I'll eat it for her. I don't have the same kind of prejudices that you Styrics do. It was overcast when they reached the port city of Cypria 3 days later. The cloud cover was high and thin, and there was no trace of moisture in it. The city was low, with squat white buildings thickly walled to ward off the heat of the southern sun. The wharves jutting out into the harbor were constructed of stone, since Rendor was a kingdom largely devoid of trees. Sparhawk and the others came up on deck, wearing hooded black robes, just as the sailors were mooring Captain Sorgi's ship to one of the wharves. They went up the 3 steps to the quarterdeck to join the curly-haired seamen. Get some fenders between our side and that wharf, Sorgi roared at the seamen who were snubbing off the mooring lines. He shook his head in disgust. I have to tell them that every single time we dock, he muttered. All they can think about when we make port is the nearest alehouse. He looked at Sparhawk.
"Well, Master Clough," he said, "have you changed your mind?"
"I'm afraid not, Captain," Sparhawk replied, setting down the bundle containing his spare clothing.
"I'd like to oblige you, but the lady I mentioned seems to have all her hopes pinned on me. It's for your own good, actually. If you show up at her house with an introduction from me, her cousins might decide to wring my location out of you, and being wrung is not anybody's idea of a good time. Besides, I don't want to take any chances." Sorji grunted. Then he looked at them all curiously.
"Where did you come by the renderish clothing?"
"I did some bargaining in your forecastle yesterday," Sparhawk shrugged, plucking at the front of the hooded black robe he wore. "Some of your sailors like to be unobtrusive when they make port here in Rendor."
"How well I know," Sorji said wryly. "I spent 3 days looking for the ship's cook the last time I was in Jirok."
He looked at Sophrenia, who was also robed in black and wore a heavy veil across her face.
"Where did you find anything to fit her?" he asked. "None of my sailors are that small."
"She's very adept with her needle." Sparhawk did not think it necessary to explain exactly how Sophrenia had changed the color of her white robe. Sorji scratched at his curly hair.
"I can't for the life of me understand why most Rendors wear black," he said. "Don't they know that it's twice as hot?"
"Maybe they haven't realized that yet," Sparhawk replied. "Rendors are none too bright in the first place, and they've only been here for 5,000 years. Sorji laughed.
"Maybe that's it," he said. "Good fortune here in Cypria, Master Clough," he said. "If I happen to run across any cousins, I'll tell them that I've never heard of you."
"Thank you, Captain," Sparhawk said, clasping Sorji's hand. "You have no idea how much I appreciate that." They led their horses down the slanting gangway to the wharf. At Keurig's suggestion, they covered their saddles with blankets to conceal the fact that they were not of renderish construction. Then they all tied their bundles to their saddles, mounted, and moved away from the harbor at an unobtrusive walk. The streets were teeming with Rendors. The city dwellers sometimes wore lighter colored clothing, but the desert people were all dressed in unrelieved black and had their hoods up. There were few women in the street, and they were all veiled. Sophrenia rode subserviently behind Sparhawk and Keurig, with her hood pulled far forward and her veil drawn tightly across her nose and mouth.
"You know the customs here, I see," Sparhawk said back over his shoulder.
"I was here many years ago," she replied, drawing her robe around Flute's knees.
"How many years?"
"Would you like to have me tell you that Cypria was only a fishing village then?" she asked archly. 20 or so mud huts?" He looked back at her sharply.
"Sophrenia, Cypria's been a major seaport for 1,500 years.
"My," she said, "has it really been that long? It seems like only yesterday. Where does the time go?"
"That's impossible," she laughed gaily.
"How gullible you can be sometimes, Sparhawk," she said. "You know I'm not going to answer that kind of question, so why keep trying?"
He suddenly felt more than a little sheepish. "I suppose I asked for that, didn't I?" he admitted.
"Yes, you did."
Keurig was grinning broadly. "Go ahead and say it," Sparhawk told him sourly.
"Say what, my lord?" Keurig's eyes were wide and innocent.
They rode up from the harbor, mingling with robed Rendors in the narrow, twisting streets. Although the overcast veiled the sun, Sparhawk could still feel the heat radiating out from the white-plastered walls of the houses and shops. He could also catch the familiar scents of Rendor. The air was close and dusty, and there was the pervading odor of mutton simmering in olive oil and pungent spices. There was the cloying fragrance of heavy perfumes, and overlaying it all was the persistent reek of the stockyards. Near the center of town they passed the mouth of a narrow alley. A chill touched Sparhawk, and suddenly, as clearly as if they were actually ringing out their call, he seemed once again to hear the sound of the bells.
"Something wrong?" Keurig asked as he saw his lord shudder.
"That's the alley where I saw Martell last time."
Keurig peered up the alley.
"Tight quarters in there," he noted.
"That's all that kept me alive," Sparhawk replied. "They couldn't come at me all at once."
"Where are we going, Sparhawk?" Sophrenia asked from the rear.
To the monastery where I stayed after I was wounded, he replied. I don't think we want to be seen in the streets. The abbot and most of the monks out there are Arshan, and they know how to keep secrets.
Will I be welcome there?
She asked dubiously.
Arshan monks are conservative, and they have certain prejudices where Styrix are concerned.
This particular abbot is a bit more cosmopolitan, Sparhawk assured her, and I have a few suspicions about his monastery anyway.
Oh?
I don't think these monks are entirely what they seem, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to find a secret armory inside the monastery, complete with burnished armor, blue surcoats, and a variety of weapons.
Cyrenix?
She asked, a bit surprised. The Pandions aren't the only ones who want to keep an eye on Rendor, he replied.
What's that smell? Kurek asked as they approached the western outskirts of town.
The stockyards, Sparhawk told him. A great deal of beef is shipped out of Cypria. Do we have to go through any kind of a gate to get out? Sparhawk shook his head. The city walls were pulled down during the suppression of the Ashandist heresy. The local people didn't bother to rebuild them. They emerged from the narrow street they were following into acre upon acre of stock pens, filled with bawling, scrubby-looking cows. It was late afternoon by now, and the overcast had begun to take on a silvery sheen.
How much farther to the monastery? Kurek asked.
A mile or so.
It's quite a distance from that alley back there, isn't it?
I noticed that myself about 10 years ago.
Why didn't you take shelter someplace closer?
There wasn't any place safe. I could hear the bells from the monastery, so I just kept following the sound. It gave me something to think about.
You could have bled to death.
That same thought crossed my mind a few times that night.
Gentlemen, Sophronia said, do you suppose we could move along? The night comes on very quickly here in Rendor, and it gets cold in the desert after the sun goes down.
The monastery lay beyond the stockyards on a high rocky hill. It was surrounded by a thick wall, and the gate was closed. Sparhawk dismounted before the gate and tugged on a stout cord hanging beside it. A small bell tinkled inside. After a moment, the shutter of a narrow, barred window cut into the stones beside the gate opened. The brown-bearded face of a monk peered out warily.
"Good evening, brother," Sparhawk said. "Do you suppose I might have a word with your abbot?"
"Can I give him your name?"
"Sparhawk. He might remember me. I stayed here for a time a few years back."
"Wait," the monk said brusquely, closing the shutter again.
"Not very cordial, is he?"
Kurek said.
"Churchmen aren't really welcome in Rendor," Sparhawk replied. "A bit of caution is probably only natural."
They waited as the twilight faded. Then the shutter opened again.
"Sir Sparhawk!"
A voice more suited to a parade ground than a religious community boomed.
"My Lord Abbot," Sparhawk replied. "Wait there a moment. We'll open the gate."
There was a rattling of chains and the grating sound of a heavy bar sliding through thick iron rings. Then the gate ponderously swung open, and the abbot came out to greet them. He was a bluff, hearty-looking man with a ruddy face and an imposing black beard. He was quite tall, and his shoulders were massive.
"It's good to see you again, my friend," he said, clasping Sparhawk's hand in a crushing grip. "You're looking well. You seemed a bit pale and wan when you left the last time you were here."
"It's been 10 years, my lord," Sparhawk pointed out. "In that length of time a man either heals or dies."
"So he does, Sir Sparhawk, so he does. Come inside and bring your friends."
Sparhawk led Farron through the gate with Sophronia and Kurek close behind. There was a court inside, and the walls surrounding it were as bleak as those surrounding the monastery. They were unadorned by the white mortar customary on the walls of Renderish buildings, and the windows which pierced them were perhaps a trifle narrower than monastic architecture would have dictated. They would, Sparhawk noted professionally, make excellent vantage points for archers.
"How can I help you, Sparhawk?" the abbot asked.
"I need refuge again, my lord abbot," Sparhawk replied.
"That's getting to be sort of a habit, isn't it?"
The abbot grinned at him.
"Who's after you this time?" he asked.
"No one that I know of, my lord, and I think I'd like to keep it that way. Is there some place we can talk privately?"
"Of course.
The abbot turned to the brown-bearded monk who had first opened the shutter. "See to their horses, brother." It was not a request, but had all the crispness of a military command. The monk straightened noticeably, though he did not quite salute. "Come along, then, Sparhawk," the abbot boomed, clapping the big knight on the shoulder with one meaty hand. Curic dismounted and went to help Sophronia. She handed flute down to him and slipped from her saddle. The abbot led them through the main door and into a vaulted stone corridor, dimly lighted at intervals by small oil lamps. Perhaps it was the scent of the oil, but the place had a peculiar odor of sanctity, and of safety, about it. That smell sharply reminded Sparhawk of the night 10 years before. "The place hasn't changed much," he noted, looking around.
"The church is timeless, Sir Sparhawk," the abbot replied sententiously, "and her institutions try to match that quality."
At the far end of the corridor, the abbot opened a severely simple door, and they followed him into a book-lined room with a high ceiling and an unlighted charcoal brazier in the corner. The room was quite comfortable-looking, far more so than the studies of abbots in the monasteries of the north. The windows were made of thick triangular pieces of glass joined with strips of lead, and they were draped in pale blue. The floor was strewn with white sheepskin rugs, and the unmade bed in the far corner was quite a bit wider than the standard monastic cot. The jammed bookcases reached from floor to ceiling.
"Please sit down," the abbot said, pointing at several chairs standing in front of a table piled high with documents.
"Still trying to catch up, my lord?" Sparhawk smiled, pointing at the documents and taking one of the chairs.
The abbot made a wry face.
"I give it a try every month or so," he replied. "Some men just aren't made for paperwork."
He looked sourly at the litter on his table.
"Sometimes I think a fire in here might solve the problem. I'm sure the clerks in Kyrelos wouldn't even miss all my reports."
He looked curiously at Sparhawk's companions.
"My man Curic," Sparhawk introduced his squire.
"Curic?"
the abbot nodded.
"And the lady is Sophronia, the Pandion instructor in the secrets."
"Sophronia herself?"
The abbot's eyes widened, and he rose to his feet respectfully.
"I've been hearing stories about you for years, madam. Your reputation is quite exalted."
He smiled broadly at her in welcome. She removed her veil and returned his smile.
"You're very kind to say so, my lord."
She sat and gathered flute up into her lap. The little girl nestled down and regarded the abbot with her large dark eyes.
"A beautiful child, Lady Sophronia," the abbot said. "Your daughter, by any chance?"
She laughed.
"Oh, no, my lord abbot," she said. "The child's a Styric foundling. We call her Flute."
"What an odd name," he murmured.
Then he returned his gaze to Sparhawk.
"You hinted at a matter you wanted to keep private," he said curiously. "Why don't you tell me about it?"
"Do you get much news about what's happening on the continent, my lord?"
"I'm kept informed, yes."
The bearded abbot said it rather cautiously as he sat down again.
"Then you know about the situation in Alania. The queen's illness, you mean? And the ambitions of Primate Annius?"
"Right.
Anyway, a while back, Annius came up with a very complicated scheme to discredit the Pandion Order. We were able to thwart it. After the general meeting in the palace, the preceptors of the four orders gathered in a private session. Annius hungers for the archprelate's throne, and he knows that the militant orders will oppose him."
"With swords, if necessary," the abbot agreed fervently.
"I'd like to cut him down myself," he added.
Then he realized that he had perhaps gone too far.
"If I weren't a member of a cloistered order, of course," he concluded lamely.
"I understand perfectly, my lord," Sparhawk assured him. "The preceptors discussed the matter, and they concluded that all of the primate's power, and any hope he has of extending it to Kyrelos, is based on his position in Alania, and he'll keep that authority only for so long as Queen Alana's indisposed." He grimaced.
"That's a silly word, isn't it? She's barely clinging to her life, and I called it indisposed." "Oh, well, you know what I'm talking about."
"We all flounder from time to time, Sparhawk," the abbot forgave him.
"I know most of the details already.
Last week I got word from Patriarch Dolmant about what was afoot. What did you find out in Barata?
We talked with a physician there, and he told us that Queen Alana has been poisoned.
The abbot came to his feet, swearing like a pirate. You're her champion, Sparhawk. Why didn't you go back to Simera and run your sword through Aeneas?
I was tempted, Sparhawk admitted, but I decided that it's more important right now to see if we can find an antidote. There'll be plenty of time later to deal with Aeneas, and I'd rather not be rushed when it gets down to that. Anyway, the physician in Barata told us that he thinks the poison is of renderish origin, and he directed us to a couple of his colleagues here in Cypria. The abbot began to pace up and down, his face still dark with rage. When he began to speak, all traces of monkly humility were gone from his voice.
If I know Aeneas, he's probably been trying to stop you every step of the way. Am I right?
Fairly close, yes.
And the streets of Cypria aren't the safest places in the world, as you found out that night 10 years ago. All right, then, he said decisively. This is the way we're going to do it. Aeneas knows that you're looking for medical advice, right?
If he doesn't, then he's been asleep.
Exactly. If you go near a physician, you'll probably need him for yourself, so I won't let you do that.
Won't let, my lord? Sophronia asked mildly.
Sorry, the abbot mumbled. Maybe I got a little carried away there. What I meant to say is that I advise against it in the strongest possible terms. What I'll do instead is send some monks out to bring the physicians here. That way you'll be able to talk with them without chancing the streets of Cypria. We'll work out a way afterward to slip you out of town.
Would an Alanian physician actually agree to call on a patient at home? Sophronia asked him.
He will if his own health is of any concern to him, the abbot replied darkly.
He suddenly looked a bit sheepish.
That didn't sound very monkly, did it? He apologized.
Oh, I don't know, Sparhawk said blandly. There are monks, and then there are monks.
I'll send some of the brothers into the city to fetch them right now. What are the names of these physicians?
Sparhawk fished the scrap of parchment the tipsy doctor in Barata had given him out of an inside pocket and handed it to the abbot. The bluff man glanced at it.
You know this first one already, Sparhawk, he said. He's the one who treated you the last time you were here.
Oh? I didn't really catch his name.
I'm not surprised. You were delirious most of the time.
The abbot squinted at the parchment.
This other one died about a month ago, he said. But Dr. Voldy here can probably answer just about any question you might have. He's a little impressed with himself, but he's the best physician in Cypria.
He rose, went to the door, and opened it. A pair of youthful monks stood outside. They were, Sparhawk noted, quite similar to the two young Pandions who normally stood guard outside Vanion's door in the chapter house in Simera.
You, the abbot sharply ordered one of them, go into the city and bring Dr. Voldy to me. Don't take no for an answer.
At once, my lord, the young monk replied. With a certain amusement, Sparhawk noted that the monk's feet twitched slightly as if he were about to snap his heels together. The abbot closed the door and returned to his seat.
It should be about an hour, I expect.
He looked at Sparhawk's grin.
Something funny, my friend? He asked.
Not at all, my lord. It's just that your young monks have a very crisp manner about them.
Does it really show that much? The abbot asked, looking a little abashed.
Yes, my lord. If you know what you're looking for, it does.
The abbot made a wry face. Fortunately, the local people aren't very familiar with that sort of thing. You'll be discreet about this discovery, won't you, Sparhawk?
Of course, my lord. I was fairly sure about the nature of your order when I left here 10 years ago, and I haven't told anyone yet.
I should have guessed, I suppose. You Pandions tend to have very sharp eyes.
He rose to his feet.
I'll have some supper sent up. There's a fairly large partridge that grows hereabouts, and I have an absolutely splendid falcon.
He laughed.
That's what I do instead of making out the reports I'm supposed to send to Kyrelos. What do you say to a bit of roast fowl?
I think we could manage that, Sparhawk replied.
And in the meantime, could I offer you and your friends some wine? It's not Arshan Red, but it's not too bad. We make it here on the grounds. The soil hereabouts isn't much good for anything but raising grapes.
Thank you, my lord abbot, Sophronia replied. But might the child and I have milk instead?
I'm afraid that all we have is goat's milk, Lady Sophronia, he apologized. Her eyes brightened.
Goat's milk would be just fine, my lord. Cow's milk is so bland, and we Styrics prefer something a bit more robust.
Sparhawk shuddered. The abbot sent the other young monk to the kitchen for milk and supper, then poured red wine for Sparhawk, Curic, and himself. He leaned back in his chair then, idly toying with the stem of his goblet.
Can we be frank with each other, Sparhawk? He asked.
Of course.
Did any word get to you in Jirok about what happened here in Cypria after you left?
Not really, Sparhawk replied. I was a bit submerged at that time.
You know how Rendors feel about the use of magic.
Sparhawk nodded.
They call it witchcraft, as I recall.
They do indeed, and they look on it as a worse crime than murder.
Anyway, just after you left, we had an outbreak of that sort of thing. I got involved in the investigation, since I'm the ranking churchman in the area.
He smiled ironically.
Most of the time, Rendors spit as I go by, but the minute somebody whispers witchcraft, they come running to me with their faces white and their eyes bulging out. Usually, the accusations are completely false. The average Rendor couldn't remember the Styric words of the simplest spell if his life depended on it. But charges crop up from time to time, usually based on spite, jealousy, and petty hatreds. This time, though, the affair was quite different. There was actual evidence that somebody in Cypria was using magic of a fair degree of sophistication.
He looked at Sparhawk.
Were any of the men who attacked you that night at all adept in the secrets?
One of them is, yes.
Perhaps that answers the question, then. The magic seems to have been a part of an attempt to locate something, or someone. Maybe you were the object of that search.
You mentioned sophistication, my lord abbot, Sophronia said intently. Could you be a bit more specific?
There was a glowing apparition stalking the streets of Cypria, he replied. It seemed to be sheathed in lightning of some kind.
She drew in her breath sharply. And what exactly did this apparition do?
It questioned people. None of them could remember the questions afterward. But the questioning appears to have been quite severe. I saw a number of the burns with my own eyes.
Burns?
The apparition would seize whomever it wanted to question. Wherever it touched them, it left a burned place. One poor woman had a burn that encircled her entire forearm. I'd almost say that it was in the shape of a hand, except that it had far too many fingers.
How many fingers?
9, and 2 thumbs.
She hissed. A Damok, she said.
I thought you said that the younger gods had stripped Martell of the power to summon those things, Sparhawk said to her.
Martell didn't summon it, she replied. It was sent to do his bidding by someone else.
It amounts to almost the same thing, then, doesn't it?
Not exactly. The Damok is only marginally under Martell's control.
But all this happened 10 years ago, Curic shrugged. What difference does it make now?
You're missing the point, Curic, she replied gravely. We thought that the Damok had appeared only recently, but it was here in Cypria 10 years ago, before anything we're involved with now even began.
I don't quite follow you, he admitted.
Sophronia looked at Sparhawk. It's you, dear one, she said in a deadly quiet voice. It's not me or Curic or Elana or even Flute. The Damok's attacks have all been directed at you. Be very, very careful, Sparhawk. Azash is trying to kill you.
Chapter 19. Dr. Voldy was a fussy little man in his 60s. His hair was thinning on top, and he had carefully combed it forward to conceal the fact. It was also quite obvious that he dyed it to hide the encroaching gray. He removed his dark cloak, and Sparhawk saw that he wore a white linen smock. He smelled of chemicals, and he had an enormous opinion of himself. It was quite late when the little physician was ushered into the abbot's littered study, and he was struggling without much success to cover his irritation at having been called out at that hour.
My Lord Abbot?
He stiffly greeted the black-bearded churchman with a jerky little bow.
Ah, Voldy, the abbot said, rising to his feet. So good of you to come. Your monk said that the matter was urgent, my lord. May I see the patient?
Not unless you're prepared to make a very long journey, Dr. Voldy, Sophronia murmured. Voldy gave her a long, appraising look.
You appear not to be a Rendor, madam, he noted. Styric, I should say, judging from your features.
Your eyes are keen, doctor.
I'm sure you remember this fellow, the abbot said, pointing at Sparhawk.
The doctor looked blankly at the big Pandion.
No, he said. I can't say that...
Then he frowned.
Don't tell me,
he added, absently brushing his hair forward with the palm of his hand.
It was about 10 years ago, wasn't it? Weren't you the one who'd been knifed?
You have a good memory, Dr. Voldy, Sparhawk said. We don't want to keep you out too late, so why don't we get down to cases? We were referred to you by a physician in Barata. He greatly respects your opinion in certain areas. Sparhawk quickly appraised the little fellow and decided to apply a bit of judicious flattery. Of course, we'd have probably come to you anyway, he added. Your reputation has spread far beyond the borders of Rendor.
Well,
Voldy said, preening himself slightly. Then he assumed a piously modest expression.
It's gratifying to know that my efforts on behalf of the sick have received some small recognition.
What we need, good doctor, Sophronia injected, is your advice in treating a friend of ours who has recently been poisoned.
Poisoned?
Voldy said sharply.
Are you sure?
The physician in Barata was quite certain, she replied. We described our friend's symptoms in great detail, and he diagnosed the condition as being the effects of a rather rare renderish poison called...
Please, madam, he said, holding up one hand. I prefer to make my own diagnoses. Describe the symptoms for me.
Of course. Patiently, she repeated what she had told the physicians at the University of Barata. The little doctor paced up and down as she talked, his hands clasped behind him and his eyes on the floor.
I think we can rule out the falling sickness right at the outset, he mused when she had finished. Some other diseases, however, do result in convulsions.
He affected a wise expression.
It's the combination of the fever and sweating that's the crucial clue, he lectured. Your friend's illness is not a natural disease. My colleague in Barata was quite correct in his diagnosis. Your friend has indeed been poisoned, and I would surmise that the poison involved was Derastim. The desert nomads here in Rendor call it deathweed. It kills sheep in the same way that it kills people. The poison is very rare, since the nomads uproot every bush they come across. Does my diagnosis agree with that of my Camorian colleague?
Exactly, Dr. Voldy, she said admiringly.
Well, that's it, then. He reached for his cloak. I'm glad to have been of help.
All right, Sparhawk said. Now what do we do?
Make arrangements for a funeral,
Voldy shrugged. What about an antidote?
There isn't any. I'm afraid your friend is doomed.
There was an irritating smugness about the way he said it.
Unlike most poisons, Derastim attacks the brain instead of the blood. Once it's ingested, poof!
He snapped his fingers.
Tell me, does your friend have rich and powerful enemies? Derastim is fearfully expensive.
The poisoning was politically motivated, Sparhawk said bleakly.
Ah, politics,
Voldy laughed.
Those fellows have all the money, don't they?
He frowned then.
It does seem to me...
He broke off, palming at his hair again.
Where did I hear that?
He scratched at his head, disturbing the carefully slicked down hair. Then he snapped his fingers again.
Ah, yes, he said triumphantly. I have it now. I've heard some rumors, only rumors, mind you, that a physician in Dabur has effected a few cures among members of the king's family in Zand. Normally, that information would have been immediately disseminated to all other physicians, but I have some suspicions about the matter. I know the fellow, and there have been some ugly stories about him circulating in medical circles for years now.
There are some who maintain that his miraculous appearing cures are the result of certain forbidden practices.
Which practices? Sophronia asked intently.
Magic, madam. What else? My friend in Dabur would immediately lose his head if word got out that he was practicing witchcraft.
I see, she said. Did this rumor about a cure come to you from one single source?
Oh, no, he replied. Any number of people have told me about it. The king's brother and several nephews fell ill. The physician from Dabur, Tanjin, his name is, was summoned to the palace. He confirmed that they had all been poisoned with Derastim. Then he cured them. Out of gratitude, the king suppressed the information of exactly how the cures were effected, and he issued Tanjin a full pardon just to make sure. He smirked. Not that the pardon is much good, mind you, since the king's authority doesn't go much beyond the walls of his own palace in Zand. Anyway, anyone with the slightest bit of medical knowledge knows how it was done. He assumed a lofty expression. I wouldn't stoop to that myself, he declared. But Dr. Tanjin is notoriously greedy, and I imagine that the king paid him handsomely.
Thank you for your assistance, Dr. Voldy, Sparhawk said then.
I'm sorry about your friend, Voldy said. By the time you get to Dabur and back, he'll be long since dead, I'm afraid. Derastim works rather slowly, but it's always fatal.
So's a sword through the belly, Sparhawk said grimly. At the very least, we'll be able to avenge our friend.
What a dreadful thought, Voldy shuddered. Are you at all acquainted with the kind of damage a sword does to someone?
Intimately, Sparhawk replied.
Oh, that's right. You would be, wouldn't you? Would you like to have me take a look at those old wounds of yours?
Thanks all the same, Doctor. They're quite healed now.
Splendid. I'm rather proud of the way I cured those, you know. A lesser physician would have lost you. Well, I must be off now. I have a full day ahead of me tomorrow.
He wrapped his cloak about him.
Thank you, Dr. Voldy, the abbot said. The brother at the door will escort you home again. My pleasure, my lord abbot. It's been a stimulating discussion.
Voldy bowed and left the room. Pompous little ass, isn't he? Curic muttered.
Yes, he is, the abbot agreed. He's very good, though.
It's thin, Sparhawk, Sophronia sighed. Very, very thin. All we have are rumors, and we don't have time for wild goose chases.
I don't see that we have any choice, do you? We have to go to Dabur. We can't ignore the slightest chance.
It may not be quite as thin as you think, Lady Sophronia, the abbot said. I know Voldy very well. He wouldn't confirm anything he hasn't seen with his own eyes. But I've heard a few rumors myself to the effect that some members of the family of the King of Rendor fell ill and then recovered.
It's all we've got, Sparhawk said. We've got to follow through on it.
The fastest way to Dabur is by sea along the coast, and then up the Goulet River, the abbot suggested.
No, Sophronia said firmly. The creature that's been trying to kill Sparhawk has probably realized by now that it failed last time. I don't think we want to be looking over our shoulders for waterspouts every foot of the way.
You'll have to go to Dabur by way of Jirok anyway, the abbot told them. You can't go overland. No one crosses the desert between here and Dabur, even at this time of year. It's totally impassable.
If that's the way we have to do it, then that's the way we'll do it, Sparhawk said.
Be careful out there, the abbot cautioned seriously. The Rendors are in a state of turmoil right now.
They're always in a state of turmoil, my lord.
This is a bit different. Arashim's at Dabur, preaching up a new holy war.
He's been doing that for over 20 years now, hasn't he? He stirs up the desert people all winter, and then in the summer they go back to their flocks.
That's what's different about this time, Sparhawk. Nobody pays much attention to the nomads, but somehow the old lunatic's beginning to sway the people who live in the cities, and that makes it a little more serious. Arashim's elated, of course, and he's holding his desert nomads firmly at Dabur. He's got quite an army. The city people in Rendor aren't all that stupid. What's impressing them so much?
I've heard that there are some people spreading rumors. They're telling the townsfolk that there's a great deal of sympathy for the resurgence of the Ashandist movement in the northern kingdoms.
That's absurd, Sparhawk scoffed.
Of course it is.
but they've managed to persuade a fair number of people here in Cypria that for the first time in centuries a rebellion against the Church might have some chance of success. Not only that, there have been fairly large shipments of arms filtering into the country. A suspicion began to grow in Sparhawk's mind. "Have you any idea who's been circulating these rumors?" he asked. The abbot shrugged. "Merchants, travelers from the north, and the like. They're all foreigners. They usually stay in that quarter near the Alanian consulate." "Isn't that curious?" Sparhawk mused. "I'd been summoned to the Alanian consulate that night when I was attacked in the street. Is Aelius still the consul?"
"Why, yes, as a matter of fact, he is."
"What are you getting at, Sparhawk?"
"One more question, my lord. Have your people by any chance seen a white-haired man going in and out of the consulate?"
"I couldn't really say. I didn't tell them to look for that sort of thing."
"You have someone particular in mind, I gather?"
"Oh, I do indeed, my lord abbot." Sparhawk rose and began to pace up and down. "Why don't I have another try at a lean logic, Sophrenia?" he said. He began to tick items off on his fingers. 1. The primate Annius aspires to the archprelate's throne. 2. All four militant orders oppose him, and their opposition could block his ambitions. 3. In order to get that throne, he must discredit or divert the Church Knights. 4. The Alanian consul here in Cypria is his cousin. 5. The consul and Martell have had dealings with each other before. I got some personal evidence of that 10 years ago.
"I didn't know that Aelius was related to the primate," the abbot said, looking a bit surprised.
"They don't make an issue of it," Sparhawk told him. "Now then," he continued, "Annius wants the Church Knights out of Kyrellos when the time comes to elect a new archprelate. What would the Church Knights do if there were an uprising here in Rendor?"
"We'd descend on the kingdom in full battle array," the abbot declared, forgetting that his choice of words clearly confirmed Sparhawk's suspicions about the nature of his order.
"And that would effectively remove the militant orders from the debate over the election in Kyrellos, wouldn't it?" Sophrenia looked at Sparhawk speculatively. "What kind of man is this Aelius?"
"He's a petty time server with little intelligence and less imagination."
"He doesn't sound very impressive."
"He isn't."
"Then someone else would have to be giving him instructions, wouldn't they?"
"Precisely."
Sparhawk turned once more to the abbot. "My lord," he said, "do you have any way to get messages to Preceptor Abriel at your mother house in Larium? Messages that can't be intercepted?"
The abbot gave him a frosty stare.
"We agreed to be frank with each other, my lord," Sparhawk reminded him. "I'm not trying to embarrass you, but this is a matter of the greatest urgency."
"All right, Sparhawk," the abbot replied a bit stiffly.
"Yes, I can get a message to Lord Abriel."
"Good.
Sophrenia knows all the details, and she can fill you in. Curic and I have something to attend to."
"Just what are you planning?" the abbot demanded.
"I'm going to pay a call on Aelius. He knows what's been going on, and I think I can persuade him to share the information. We need confirmation of all this before you send the message to Larium."
"It's too dangerous."
"Not as dangerous as having Annius in the archprelacy, is it?" Sparhawk considered it. "Do you happen to have a secure cell someplace?" he asked.
"We have a penitence cell down in the cellar. The door can be locked, I suppose."
"Good. I think we'll bring Aelius back here to question him. Then you can lock him up. I can't let him go once he knows I'm here, and Sophrenia disapproves of random murders. If he just disappears, there'll be some uncertainty about what happened to him."
"Won't he make an outcry when you take him captive?"
"Not very likely, my lord," Curic assured him, drawing his heavy dagger. He slapped the hilt solidly against his palm. "I can practically guarantee that he'll be asleep." The streets were quiet. The overcast, which had obscured the sky that afternoon, had cleared, and the stars were very bright overhead.
"No moon," Curic said quietly as he and Sparhawk crept through the deserted streets.
"That's a help."
It's been rising late the past 3 nights, Sparhawk said.
How late?
We've got a couple more hours.
Can we make it back to the monastery by then?
We have to.
Sparhawk stopped just before they reached an intersection and peered around the corner of a house. A man wearing a short cape and carrying a spear and a small lantern was shuffling sleepily along the street.
Watchman, Sparhawk breathed, and he and Keurig stepped into the shadows of a deeply recessed doorway.
The watchman plodded on past, the lantern swinging from his hand, casting looming shadows against the walls of the buildings.
He should be more alert, Keurig growled disapprovingly.
Under the circumstances, your sense of what's proper might be a little misplaced.
Right is right, Sparhawk, Keurig replied stubbornly.
After the watchman was out of sight, they crept on up the street.
Are we just going to walk up to the gate of the consulate? Keurig asked.
No. When we get close to it, we'll go in over the rooftops.
I'm not a cat, Sparhawk. Leaping from roof to roof isn't my idea of entertainment.
The houses are all built up against each other in that part of town. The rooftops are just like a highway.
Oh, Keurig grunted. That's different, then.
The consulate of the Kingdom of Elenia was a fairly large building surrounded by a high, white-mortared wall. There were torches set on long poles at each corner, and a narrow lane running alongside the wall.
Does that lane run all the way around it? Keurig asked.
It did the last time I was here.
There's a significant hole in your plan, then, Sparhawk. I can't jump all the way from one of these rooftops to the top of that wall.
I don't think I could, either. Sparhawk frowned. Let's go around and look at the other side.
They crept through a series of narrow streets and alleys that wound along the back sides of the houses facing the consulate wall. A dog came out and barked at them until Keurig shied a rock at him. The dog yelped and ran off on 3 legs.
Now I know how a burglar feels, Keurig muttered.
There, Sparhawk said.
There where?
Right over there.
Some helpful fellow is doing some repairs on his roof. See that pile of beams stacked up against the side of that wall? Let's go see how long they are.
They crossed the alley to the stack of building material. Keurig studiously measured the beams off with his feet.
Marginal, he observed.
We'll never know until we try, Sparhawk told him.
All right. How do we get up on the roof?
We'll lean the beams against the wall. If we slant them upright, we should be able to scramble up and then pull them up after us.
I'm glad you don't have to construct your own siege engine, Sparhawk, Keurig observed sourly.
All right, let's try it.
They leaned several beams against the wall, and Keurig, grunting and sweating, hauled himself up to the roof.
All right, he whispered down over the edge.
Come on up.
Sparhawk climbed up the beam, picking up a large splinter in his hand in the process. Then he and Keurig laboriously hauled the beams up after them, and carried them one by one across the roof to the side facing the consulate wall. The flickering torches atop the wall cast a faint glow across the rooftops. As they were carrying the last beam, Keurig stopped suddenly.
Sparhawk, he called softly.
What?
2 roofs over. There's a woman lying there.
How do you know it's a woman?
Because she's stark naked, that's how.
Oh, Sparhawk said, that. It's a renderish custom. She's waiting for the moon to rise. They have a superstition here that the first rays of the moon on a woman's belly increases her fertility.
Won't she see us?
She won't say anything if she does. She's too busy waiting for the moon.
Press on, Keurig. Don't stand there gawking at her.
End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.